science, art, and everything nice. These are the things we'll be talking about on today's episode.
Go on.
Oh, that's all I had. So yes, science and art, those are words that we don't often hear together.
Yeah, we've been taught that science and art exist on opposite planes.
Right? When you mention science, people imagine a lab coat, structure, goggles, precision, gloves, the scientific method. It all promotes this narrative that scientists have to be objective and have no room for creativity.
But the truth is, science is a creative process. When we think of the things we want to solve, we create a design in our mind about how it unfolds, and we develop ways to understand or test it by thinking creatively, using the facts that we are already given.
Science and art exist together on multiple planes. Science can be used as a tool for art, and vice versa.
Scientific concepts are like stories, which involve a lot of creative processes. And every piece of art has a story, which can come together in a formulaic fashion.
But how exactly are these two disciplines connected?
Great question. In this mini-series, we will be uncovering this and introducing you to a number of talented people who have mastered this intersection between science and art.
That's right, it's a two-parter. And in this episode, we discuss how science influences art and how it can be used as a creative tool. And in the second part, we'll discuss ways art serves as a tool to disentangle science. Stay tuned.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Carry the One Radio. My name is Devika.
And I'm Celia. And today we have a very special episode on science and art. Spoiler alert, they are not mutually exclusive.
We have at least two examples. Today, we'll introduce you to Subha and Alex. We love them.
My name is Subha Subramaniam.
She, her.
My name is Alex Naka. My pronouns are he, him.
They're two very different people who have managed to blend art and science in beautiful and unexpected ways.
I am artistic director of Academy, which is a South Asian dance organization, a national South Asian dance organization based in London.
I'm currently a bioinformatics scientist at a startup called Coda Biotherapeutics in South San Francisco.
If it isn't already obvious, their career paths could not be less similar, but stick with us, it all comes full circle in the end.
As an artistic director with scientific training, Subha's dance projects are often the result of cross-collaborations with scientific researchers and academics. But before she started working with them, she fell in love with dance, which entered her life way before science.
My passion for dance came entirely out of disco. It was always disco first before any other type of dance. At a really, really young age, I was always dancing at family gatherings. We have no artists in the family as such, but I was always surrounded by music. There was always something playing, and also being born and brought up in Malaysia. So it was actually different languages. So I was always exposed to Malay songs, English songs, Tamil Carnatic music, Tamil film music, Chinese music. At about age 7, I insisted that my mum took me to a Bharatanatyam dance class. And then that's where the sort of classical training began. I've been sort of dancing in some capacity ever since. I enjoyed the physicality of it a lot. I really enjoyed what it did to the body in the way that you physicalize the form. I also loved the expressive element of it. So it felt that I wasn't just dancing, that I was doing more than that.
Like many classical dance forms, Bharatanatyam is taught in a methodical and systematic way, which means you learn things progressively. First, you start with individual steps and hand gestures, and then you build from that to learn the more complex dance routines that you see on stage today. In fact, it's actually not too different from learning scientific concepts in class.
At school, I went down the science route. I was really interested in sort of scientific process, in the thinking and the curiosity that goes with discovery and learning and understanding the way the world works. And so went on to do a degree in biochemistry at King's College in London. And all the way through, I was still dancing. I was still, although not professionally, I was still dancing all the way through my degree at my dance school performing. And then after I finished my degree, I took 2 years out to dance because I suddenly realized that actually this is the time for me to do this. So I then worked for various dance companies, was a dancer in education for a company. And it was a dancer in education post that made me realize that actually it was teaching that I was really interested in. But I didn't want to teach dance, but I actually was really interested in teaching science. I then went on and did a postgraduate certificate in education, became a science teacher, and then started teaching science sort of part-time whilst dancing. And that's when I set up my very first company with another dance colleague. The company was called Angika. And we then just started to experiment with the form.
So cool. Suba had quite the journey. I wonder what Alex's path was like.
Well, across the pond, Alex graduated with a PhD in neuroscience from UC Berkeley and started exploring art at the very end of grad school. His jam is something called generative art. Now, he'll tell us all about it in a minute, but just to get us on the same page now, generative art is an umbrella term for an art form. It can be music, literature, digital art, you name it, that's partially or fully created with an autonomous system. Kind of like those cool patterns you see in a kaleidoscope. They're beautiful, but they're created by something that's not entirely under the artist's control.
One of the things that actually kind of opened the door into it for me was the process of learning how to do scientific programming, which I did during my PhD studies at Berkeley. Closer to sort of like what actually got me into doing generative art versus just being a nerd, there are sort of two things that I can point to. So one of them was, at some point during grad school, I went to a museum and I cannot for the life of me remember where it was or what museum it was, but I saw a bunch of pieces of basically early generative art from the 60s and 70s. I really adored it. It just like really struck me as, you know, this like very like elegant form of art. It's very simple and yet striking and interesting. The other thing I remember about it is kind of being like, wow, this is it's just like a few lines. Like, I feel like I could do this, which I think is something that for abstract art in general, people kind of always think that. And the same comes up a lot for generative art. I mean, a lot of ways it's true. I think like pretty much anybody can make this stuff if they want to. And the actual sort of jumping into things was at the end of grad school, I pretty much decided I wanted to try to just learn a lot more about programming. And was taking on a lot of practice projects. I had it in my head that I wanted to write a program that would simulate the growth of a tree or something that looked like a tree. And I had kind of been just sort of toying with that for a while. And then at some point I was on this pretty long trip that involved a lot of long bus rides through Peru and just was sort of playing with my laptop this entire time on it and kind of like toying with this thing. And at the end of it, had stuff that looked sort of like passable trees to me. And also a lot of stuff that didn't look like trees, but that I still thought it looked cool. And so that was sort of like the first time that I ever really deliberately kind of worked on making something for no purpose other than creating some piece of art that I liked. Pretty much from that seed, I've kind of just leaned into really spending a lot of my free time on it.
Hi, listener. Do you like our content? Carry the One Radio would love to have you as a patron. If you're interested, stick around to the end of the episode to find out ways to support us. Now back to the episode.
Okay, so two very basic questions.
Shoot.
I get that Suba is a dancer and Alex is a scientist slash emerging artist, but what exactly do they do? What does this dance look like? And how exactly does Alex generate this art?
I had the same questions. Let's start with Suba. She is a Bharatanatyam dancer. It's one of the oldest classical dance forms in India. Ballet has been around since the 15th century, which sounds old, right? Bharatanatyam, on the other hand, has been around since the 2nd century, maybe even earlier.
I would say it's a dance form that's incredibly sculptural. It's rooted in a codified way of learning and practicing. It is full of myths, stories, and storytelling. It is rich in gesture, and it is rich in its codification, even to the level of how a classical dancer is dressed. The costume is colorful, there are flowers in the hair, but every single bit of what a classical dancer wears is codified. It's so deeply rooted in tradition that, yeah, it's almost like watching temple sculptures come alive and move. There is that sort of classicism within the forms, which have been sort of there for a very, very long time. And some things have changed, whereas some things haven't. So in that sense, there is a similarity in terms of ballet and Bharatanatyam. However, with Bharatanatyam, it's just more colourful, almost in every sense of the word. You know, from stories to the form, to the storytelling, to the jewellery, to the sculptures, to all of it. Yes, there are set stories, but the way in which the form has evolved over the years, for it to sit in a on a contemporary stage, in a contemporary setting, it still sits, it still holds, it still is relevant in so many ways.
Okay, so we know that Bharatanatyam is old, but it's still relevant today because it's adaptable. Every tiny detail of gesture and movement is timeless, like using the same alphabet to create stories over hundreds of years. Now, how about Alex's form? It's not centuries old, right?
Not at all. At least as we know it now, generative art has a much more recent history, and it has a lot more in common with computer science than what we might think of as classical art.
Generative art, I would say, is art that these days is usually done with computers and involves some kind of element of it being a little bit out of the artist's control, so sort of procedurally generated. A really important element of generative art is that it almost always involves some element of randomness.
So podcasts are famously not a visual medium, but let me at least try to describe one of these pieces of art for you. So picture a circle with 1,000 circles inside of it, drawn with robotic precision. And inside of each of those circles, there are squiggles and grids and shapes that all seem to blend together perfectly, but with a little dash of chaos thrown in there. And these are like perfectly round circles and perfectly straight lines, nothing that a normal person could draw by hand.
Okay, but how do you make something like that?
Well, it depends. Alex gets a little help from his new friend.
So I have a pen plotter. I usually just call it Robot. I'm on a first name basis with it. And it's pretty much just a machine for holding and manipulating a pen. Plotter art, which is art made with pen plotters, involves, again, a process of having a robot pick up a pen, make marks on paper. It is different than the process that most people are used to with printing something on paper, in that a printer takes information that is pretty much like a raster graphic, so sort of a grid of values of black, cyan, magenta, yellow, and says, oh, I'm going to print this much of each color at each of these locations on this grid. A plotter takes vectors and tells this robot holding a pen to place the pen on paper and follow a path. Pen plotters have motors on them, right? And all they can really do is listen to instructions about what to do with their motors. The challenge with making art in this medium is that what you have to do is take this small, simple unit of just like, you know, marks on paper, right, like lines, and build that up into something bigger. And I think that a lot of the very best generative art that is being made right now, in my opinion, are things that start with pretty much simple rules, so like algorithms, and find ways to take those and make things emerge out of them. Generative art involves kind of really the collision of three things, I think. Some of it is creating algorithms to do stuff. Some of it is human intervention, and some of it is randomness. Another element of it is basically figuring out which parts of the thing you're making you want to be kind of like hard and fast rules, and which things you want to be random or parameterized in some way that it gives you a knob to sort of turn and be like, oh, I want this to be a thing that I can change and maybe regenerate in like different random ways.
That already sounds more sciencey than I thought art would be. Like, come on. Parameterized? That's peak science vibes.
Yeah, the process of creating generative art is almost like the process of creating a science experiment. From planning, to failing, to planning again, to failing again.
For me, part of the process of kind of making this art also for me is trying to learn how to do new things.
We asked him to give an example of how you'd make something from start to finish, because, again, the final products look nuts. We linked his Instagram and Twitter accounts in the show notes so that you can see, but they're these, like, incredibly complex illustrations, these fractals and concentric shapes and the teeniest, tiniest details.
Like the cover of an old calculus textbook.
Yeah, exactly. Mathematicians love this stuff. Here's how Alex made one of these masterpieces.
I got this idea that I wanted to try to recreate a doodle that I have been doing for as long as I can remember writing stuff on paper, which is basically the idea with it is I draw a circle, and then on the edge of that circle, I draw another semicircle that connects to it. And then next to that, I'll draw another semicircle and just kind of keep layering little semicircles around this thing and packing them together. And at the end of it, you get something that looks a little bit like the inside of a sunflower. One thing I wanted to do was figure out how can I create primitives, so like small shapes like circles or squares, and handle the intersection and occlusion of them with each other. And so the starting point for that is figuring out, okay, so how do you do this? What I did was to create an algorithm that proceeds in steps where you start with a circle, you draw a new circle through that same process, but you make a bunch of sort of candidate circles on there, and then you pick the one that is the closest to the starting circle. Eventually I was like, okay, I can recreate this doodle that I did a while ago, but what happens if I change some things in here? So one parameter that I might think about in making this process is, how many guesses does it get to take before it picks a new circle? If you give it many guesses to try to find the one circle that is sort of closest to the center of this blob, then what you'll end up with is something that looks like this very orderly, close packing structure that looks a lot like a sunflower. But if you give it only a few guesses, then you get something that looks a little bit more disorderly or organic in some ways.
It's so cool that he was able to take an idea, a doodle that had just been simmering in his brain forever, and turn it into real physical art. It kind of makes me appreciate my own doodles.
Absolutely. And Suba kind of does the same thing.
Usually I have an idea and then it sits with me for quite a long time. I have to sort of digest it before I can make something about the, you know, what it is that I want to make work. So I've been really fortunate to have a lot of different things that have inspired me.
She told us about one project she made for Sadhana, one of her dance companies, which definitely pulls inspiration from all corners of her brain.
So one of the first pieces I made for Sadhana was called the Shiva, and it was all about what makes us shiver, whether it's through pain, through pleasure, through being cold, or just through the sheer beauty of having seen something or felt something that you can't always articulate.
This project wasn't just informed by science, but was kind of designed to inspire science too.
Trying to find different ways to engage people, and you know, young people especially, in science was something that I thought, actually, this is really quite interesting. And what happens if I make work about science? Could I instill something in people to want to then be interested in the subject? So when I started creating work that had quite strong scientific conceptual sort of ideas around the work, what I realized was that the idea of the art is not to teach. The idea of the art is to instill a curiosity in people. When I started to think about science as being the thing that I wanted to create different scientific ideas or subjects or concepts, that's when I realized that dance can play a role in the public engagement of science.
In the case of the shiver, it was all about sparking curiosity about the brain and the body.
I met this wonderful neuroscientist called Professor Morten Kringelbach. And he's a neuroscientist. So very early on, I decided I was going to work with people with very interesting names. Doesn't always work, but I've managed a few. So Morten and I met through a talk that I did called The Creative Brain. And we both got really excited about the potential of creating dance that had a massive neuroscience element to it. And then I commissioned a wonderful poet called Lem Sisse, who'd made a radio program about, and it was called The Shiver, about your body's capacity to regulate its own body temperature. We all got together. I met these amazing audiovisual artists and a lighting designer. And then we all sat down. We got Morten in the room. And Morten talked us through lots and lots of different things about neuroscience, about the way our brains work, neurons, different kinds of neurons, motor neurons, and, you know, about movement and how our brains work. He showed us videos of people going through deep brain stimulation to stop pain, where he's worked with surgeons, where they stick electrodes in your head to understand, you know, this very fine line between pain and pleasure, because it's expressed in the same part of the brain. And then I worked with three dancers with a scientist in the room. And then in a way, what we all do is go away and express what we've heard, understood, all that research in our own art forms. So the audiovisual artists are doing the same sort of thing that I'm doing with movement. The lighting designer is thinking in the same way as I'm doing with movement. The costume designer is looking at the movement and thinking of what. So that's how it all works. And then we just work collaboratively together. Every element of it, of the work, is connected always to the idea that we started off with.
Love everything about that amazing collaboration. It kind of reminds me of something Alex said about parameterization. It'll make sense, I promise. When he was talking about writing instructions for his pen plotter, he said,
so this is another element of it, is basically figuring out which parts of the thing you're making you want to be kind of like hard and fast rules, and which things you want to be random or parameterized. One of the sort of core ideas of generative art is taking simple rules and then discovering things within them. You end up with this sort of like incredible, like infinite complexity for many of them. And I think that that's a lot of what makes them very beautiful, is just that you can sort of perceive both this elegant simplicity and also just great depth of how much complex information is in there.
In Suba's case, she allows her dancers to be that emergent property in her art.
I think about the form, and the form is a starting point. And I would give the dancers a series of steps, and I will say that that is your parameter within which you work. So if anything, for me, that allows you to be even more creative, if you really bring down, you know, you tighten those parameters. And working with dancers, the thing that I love is the creativity. You know, I would have thought of doing X with a particular step, but, you know, they would do X, Y, Z, B and D and put it together and it would look utterly beautiful. So dancers are collaborators, really, in the space with me. I just direct and construct and put the piece together, but actually the movement is created by the dancers. And that, for me, is one of the most beautiful things to see, is the creativity that comes out of a process. And for me, the process is almost more exciting than the thing itself sometimes.
Isn't that the whole thing with Bob Ross and his paintings? Enjoying the journey? We don't make mistakes, just happy little accidents.
It sure is. And to quote Hannah Montana circa 2009, it's the climb. And one thing Alex discovered while exploring his own art is that the process and the mistakes that come with it, it's the best part.
I'm kind of a STEM guy, definitely. I've always thought of myself as being, I'm more sciencey, I'm not very arty. And I think that a little bit of that for me is, it can be difficult for me to be okay with doing anything if I don't feel like I'm doing it well. When I was at Berkeley, I took a few drawing classes. I have my own pretty strong internal self-critic that was telling me, you know, this is not that good. And, it's, you know, that's part of being a beginner at stuff, but also in many cases it made it hard for me to get really started with stuff. There is a part of generative art where one it's really easy to make mistakes, and it's easy to make mistakes that are very interesting. There is also an element of it that I really like, which is that as compared to, I think, a lot of other forms of art, it tends to be a little bit less about representing reality. It's just totally abstract patterns, sort of a reductionist view of art in some ways, where it's just like, what are the very simple elements that make up visual experience, and how can they be combined together in a way that looks good, that looks cool, that is beautiful or appealing. I found myself able to just make a lot of things and basically be ruled by just how I felt about how, you know, these curves and lines and simple shapes look together, rather than, oh, did I, you know, draw that box well enough? Did I draw this like figure of this person well enough? Basically a chance to set my own definition of what's good and what's not good.
So far, we have learned about how Suba draws inspiration from science for her art form dance. This has not only helped explain numerous scientific concepts like temperature regulation in the shiver, but also how art ignites scientific curiosity.
And Alex has talked us through his methodology of creating generative art, which not only draws from a lot of math and programming, but also involves some simplicity and randomness. And if we haven't convinced you of this mutually beneficial relationship between science and art already, let's scale back and dive into how creativity and the scientific process relate to each other.
One of the things that has really drawn me to making generative art is the creativity that you exercise in this process feels to me a lot like what it feels like to exercise creativity in science, which, you know, is my day job. When I was like learning about science growing up, it was hard for me to see how it sort of fit into things, because the scientific method looks like a rigid system for figuring things out. And I think one of my favorite things about my scientific training was learning about the ways that you do get to exercise creativity.
Well said, Alex. Sometimes it feels challenging to imagine this overlap between creativity and science, but there are so many examples that date way, way back.
It can be sort of hard to see from the outside of science. So on the one hand, people, I think, definitely associate creativity with sort of the like scientific greats of history, right? Like if you think about Apple dropping on Isaac Newton's head, and then he has, you know, this little moment of inspired creativity and comes up with this totally new way of thinking about things. There are a couple of different ways where it comes up a lot. So one of them is just figuring out what is a good question to ask. What is interesting? What's important? And what is knowable? What can be figured out at that moment in time? And then once you have a question, there's a process of generating good hypotheses. And then finally, there's kind of this last stage of figuring out how to test these things. And so that pretty much means designing experiments and solving problems. As scientists, you can think of examples of, oh, wow, that was like a really elegant way to address that problem. The trick to it is that it's creativity within this very constrained setting. It's this cycle of defining a set of constraints, a problem to be solved, and then trying to figure it out. And then along the way of adapting and stepping back again, and then resetting your constraints, doing it all over again.
This iterative process used in scientific discovery is really similar to how many art forms are developed too. And it's apparent in generative art, as Alex describes.
Something that like happens all the time in making generative art, you start with just a seed of an idea and you think about different ways to do it. But if you're like me, then you're going to make a ton of mistakes along the way. But a lot of them will turn out to be very interesting looking mistakes. And one of the things that's great about it is that if I see something that a new, more interesting question or like hypothesis to be generating ideas towards, then you can just drop what you're doing and start working towards that. And frequently what you end up with is kind of like little seeds of things or little new things that you can pick up and put in your toolbox and then mix together with other things back down the road. So it really feels whole lot like exploring and discovering things. Like kind of there are sort of these like little patterns waiting to be found that I didn't even really make myself. They were already there and I found them.
You hear this kind of thing all the time, right? To be truly creative, you need to toss out the rules in order to free your mind. But actually, sometimes when you have less to work with, you start to see the world differently.
Exactly. When there are no limits to the creative process, you're more likely to fall into the path of least resistance. That is, you'll end up doing the thing that makes the most sense intuitively. And as a result, you're not really investing in the development of better ideas.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Constraints can provide focus and a creative challenge.
What excites me the most is when the scientist tells me they think differently about the way they do stuff after having collaborated with us as artists. That's what's most interesting, because I think a lot of the time, I feel that, and I say this openly because I'm sure I've been guilty of this too, is we as artists just take from the science to inspire us to make work. But actually, what's happening with the scientists or the academics or the people that we're working with, has it shifted anything about their practice and their process and their thinking?
Seeing this mutually beneficial relationship between science and art, we were curious to see to what extent they may have influenced one another. In Suba's case, we asked if pursuing science made her a better dancer. She said,
I don't know if it makes you better at anything. It makes you more aware of things. You do get a sense of yourself, your physicality, your body, the space you move in, the way in which you move, your embodiment of things that you're trying to say. So you kind of push it. I know we do, and we're trained in our form to do that, right? So if I say to some of my dancers, actually, I really want you to look at this fine line between pain and pleasure in that little movement section. You know, I see the pain, but I'm not seeing the pleasure and I'm not seeing the in-between bit. So actually, how do we embody that? So it kind of makes you think slightly differently.
So it doesn't necessarily make one better, but it expands one's perspective. That's a win in my book.
So as a dancer, you are kind of dancing about the things that are present and that you understand possibly and feel and have experienced, or is more, you're embodying it possibly through a lived-in experience, but possibly not. And for my science background, as a science teacher, having the art has always been a huge bonus. It's a way in. It's just, for me, an absolute way in. Sometimes when I can't find a scientific way to explain, I might slightly go down a different route. That might be art. Sometimes art allows a way in the way we think and we process. There are so many, again, cliched, but synergies in process, right? Science is creative. If you're not creative, you can't do a whole process. You can't go from A to B without going through paths and going down one and not working, going down the other and being creative about where the next bit is. I think science is hugely creative.
If you'd like to learn more about what Suba is working on, be sure to check out Academy, the South Asian dance organization she currently directs in London, on Instagram at Academy Dance and Twitter at Academy.
And if you want to be mesmerized by videos and stills of Alex's generative art, you can follow him at GottaPatchemAll on Twitter or at BB_bygones on Instagram. We'll include both of those links in our show notes. Beyond using science to inform art and as a creative tool, in the next part of our Science and Art series, we talk to two other people about ways to use art to transform our understanding of science, scientific communication, and advocacy. Stay tuned.
This episode was produced by myself, Stella Belongu, Celia Ford, and Devika Nair, with help from the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. Thank you so much to Suba Subramaniam and Alex Naka for their time, and to you for listening. This episode would not have been possible without the enormously generous support of our Patreon supporter. So I'd like to thank this episode's science producers, Sama Ahmed, Carly Van Orstel, Janine Cuevas, Samantha and Kona Esselman, and David Cabral for supporting us financially through our Patreon. If you'd like to support us by donating as well, you can head over to patreon.com/carrytheone. We have Patreon rewards at every support level, and we're grateful for any amount of support. You can also share our podcast with everyone you know and leave us a review. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and start a conversation. With that, have a beautiful day, and as always, stay curious.